Good morning, everyone, both those who are here in the hall, as well as those online. It's a lovely opportunity to come together and spend the day practicing Dhamma, reflecting on Dhamma. And the theme for today is around Ajahn Chah, one of the things that I thought I would do was just give different perspectives on Ajahn Chah's teachings and some of the important things, well, things that I thought were important anyway, and but we'll get to that. Maybe we'll begin by sitting quietly, start the day, settling the mind, and so people want to, I mean, everybody's seated already, so just to make yourself comfortable. And picking up on that theme of Ajahn Chah, I mean, there is no such thing as the Ajahn Chah method of meditation. So that Ajahn Chah was quite adept at trying to adapt the teachings and the methods of practice for individuals, and he certainly encouraged everybody to experiment for themselves and try to figure out what actually works, what works for you, what works for us, as opposed to following some mandated process. I mean, he was asked one time if he gave regular interviews for his students, his meditation students or his monastics, and he said, no, I just try to encourage people to learn how to interview themselves. And so it's really important because oftentimes we're waiting for either the advice of a respected teacher or the kind of the guidance of somebody else, and we tend to overlook our own inner resources, and that's something that Ajahn Chah really encouraged. And certainly the life in the monastery of Ajahn Chah's monastery, you were encouraged to be reflecting, investigating, practicing, along with participating in the daily routine. The regular morning and evening chanting, the alms around the meal, chores that were done on a daily basis, looking after the monastery, because even if you live in a monastery, things don't get done for you. You have to look after themselves, and just learning how to live together as a community. And so that's something that is sometimes missed, in especially from the lay perspective, that somehow monasteries are kind of rarefied retreat centers where the monks are just meditating all the time. I can assure you that's not how it works. there's just a lot of practical reality of looking after a place, and that was something that Ajahn Chah used to encourage his senior monastics. He said, be very careful what you build, because you've got to look after it. Mm-hmm. And so when you're looking after it, you tend to focus on simplicity. So again, in that theme of how using the meditation throughout our day. I mean, part of a big part of our day is also sitting quietly and meditating. But also Ajahn Chah would encourage a lot of reflection or investigation, so that to, besides trying to settle the mind and bringing the mind to a place of stillness, he would encourage a lot of investigation. There's a really paying attention to the experience of our mind and see it through the light of anicca, dukkha, anatta, of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self, and to be paying attention to the way that the mind reacts, because that's what the mind does, it reacts to things. So that what are our reactions? Are they skillful? Are they unskillful? Are they useful? Are they not useful? Do they lead to peace or do they lead to confusion? So that's rather than waiting for some magical moment when everything becomes clear and you're forever peaceful after. You've got to be willing to investigate and pay attention to the content of one's experience, but also this is knowing how to not get caught up in the in the world. And when we say the world, it's also the world is our mind, how we experience it, the avenue whereby we do experience the world. It's like Ajahn Chah say, one who gets lost in the world gets lost in their moods. One who gets lost in their moods gets lost in the world. That's the nature of our experience. So just developing a foundation of clarity in the mind so that we can see more clearly. One of the most common meditation practices and techniques that were used by Ajahn Chah was, of course, as is most common in all Buddhist countries, the mindfulness of breathing. Paying attention to one's posture, sitting with an upright body, not slumping, bring your kind of energy without getting too tense, too tight. There's this nice balance that is really helpful for meditation, where it's you're sitting upright. The breathing is nice and smooth because you are upright. You're not leaning to the right, leaning to the left, leaning forward, leaning backwards, but you're sitting nice and upright. But not trying too hard. We're not sort of in a ramrod soldier's attention. It's a different uprightness. It's a comfortable one. Paying attention to the sensation of the breath as it comes in, sensation at the tip of the nose as it passes the chest, as the abdomen rises, then as the abdomen falls, sensation of that falling, sensation at the chest, sensation at the tip of the nose, that rhythm of the breath. And after one has paid it, and one could do that the whole period if one wants, but also there tends to be a time when it starts to feel comfortable and settled, and one can focus on one particular point, whether it's at the abdomen or the chest area or the tip of the nose. It's whatever feels comfortable. Just so that bringing the attention and awareness of that breathing process to one point. When we talk about one pointing the mind, I've always found it helpful to not try to force the mind onto a point. And there is that, the word we use commonly in the English language and in meditation circles is concentration, concentrate the mind. Samadhi is often translated as right concentration, or right samadhi, right samma samadhi, right concentration, which is okay, just literally the word concentrate means to make small. So to making your mind too small is really uncomfortable sometimes. You're trying to concentrate and you're making the mind small. So it's just this one point is not a point that is trying to push away or exclude anything. But having a point that includes is spacious. There's a certain open clarity to awareness. And I find that quite helpful as an image of, say, a point that includes. It doesn't have to exclude anything, just to push anything away. Whatever arises has a place. We can know it, but we can also let it go. You don't have to annihilate it, and just let it go, and rather than chasing after it or being too concerned about it. So that sense of coming to the using the rhythm of the breath, the sensation of the breath, as a vehicle to allow a clarity and spaciousness to establish itself. A method that Ajahn Chah used to use and is widely taught in the northeast of Thailand is also using like a meditation word in conjunction with the breath, which in Thai works quite neatly because they pronounce the word Buddha in a slightly different way, Buddho. So on the in-breath, Buddha, and out-breath, To. So just, going to adjust that to Buddha. And it's just trying to use these two simple syllables to direct attention to just staying with the object of attention. Using the name of the Buddha is helpful in the sense that the Buddha is a refuge for us, one of the jewels, triple gem, and Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. But also on the meaning of the word Buddha, it's a great reminder of what we're trying to do in the sense of Buddha is this sense of knowing, of awareness, this quality, this knowing awareness. Also, it has the literal meaning of being awake, this awakening to truth, awakening to the way things truly are. And also the quality of a kind of brightness and radiance. These are the kind of a constellation of meanings of the word Buddha, the one who knows, the awakened one, the radiant one. But these are not qualities of somebody else. I mean, they are, but they're also qualities which we can direct our attention to and allow to arise within our own hearts, or to tap into those qualities within ourselves. So just being with the knowing, it's intrinsic to our nature. This quality of awakening and being awake, alert, present, is intrinsic to our nature, and we forget about it, or we miss the point. Quality of radiance and kind of happiness. When we don't get in the way, it's amazing how bright the mind really can be. Just learning how to step back and allow this quality of knowing to be present. And we can do that each in-breath, each out-breath. So it's renewing one's acquaintance with the knowing. And of course, you know, we drift off or we forget or whatever. But we just return attention to the knowing, and it is right there. You know, we don't have to chase after it. We don't have to run after it. It is there if we don't forget it. So that's something that, in terms of a way of teaching, a way of that that Ajahn Chah used to introduce the meditation, and with that settling, and then being willing to turn the attention to reflection and investigation. Sometimes the settling and calming of the mind helps the mind to become more clear in its investigation. Sometimes the investigation helps the mind be more clear and calm, and allows one to say, to drop the that investigation and return to clarity. There's no sort of absolute right in this. It's what is it that helps the mind, the heart, be clear, be steady. And both those aspects are needed. And it's something that Ajahn Chah, you know, because it's an age-old question, you know, do you need to develop? You know, how much samatha do you need before you do vipassana? How much vipassana is there? And it goes on and on. It's like, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? I mean, it's an endless cycle that there is no definitive answer. It's but what actually works for you? What helps the mind become more steady and clear? What helps the heart become more free from suffering, from dis-ease, discontent? So that this is an important foundation to be laying for oneself. Anyway, this is I was going to give a brief introduction of Ajahn Chah's approach to meditation practice, and then say it, but talk longer. Let's sit. So we could just transition to have a bit of walking meditation. I'll for about half an hour. It's 9:45 now. We could, if somebody could ring a bell at 10:15, we can come back into the hall. I'll give a teaching, Dhamma teaching, then, but at. But it'd be nice to begin the morning with some sitting meditation, walking meditation. People, in terms of walking meditation, those who aren't familiar with walking meditation and just normally just going and finding a spot, whether it's, there's a lot of people here today, so outside would probably be, most people are going to need to be outside. It's finding a flat spot where you can walk back and forth, usually about 15, 20, 25 paces, that just slowly walking back and forth. Doesn't have to be super slow. Just be, again, just finding a level of comfort and ease and just changing posture and using the same attention that you would in paying attention to the breath, but paying attention to the sensation of your movement of lifting a foot, setting it down, lifting a foot, setting it down. There's a paying attention to the body, rooting, grounding attention in a bodily presence. And if reflections come up in the mind, then to pay attention to that. And again, not getting, because sometimes there is a blur between reflections and proliferations. And so that you want to be pursuing those things that investigating experience, but you don't want to be just proliferating on everything that flits through your mind. One of Ajahn Chah's admonitions, you know, be very careful. The mind is a liar and a cheat. You don't want to trust it too far. We can tangle ourselves up in our minds. Just, what is it that creates more space and more clarity? So if people want to transition, anybody wants to continue sitting, they're more than welcome to. So try to preserve the kind of the calm and quiet of the space if there are people who want to continue sitting, and then we'll come back at 10:15. And again, welcome everyone. today's teaching was titled or billed as Perspectives on Buddhist Practice from Ajahn Chah. And so what it what I thought to do was to try to focus on a few areas of Ajahn Chah's teaching that I think were he saw as important and I think are, you know, say very helpful for us in the West and to a certain degree. Tend to be things that are maybe not so much emphasized in the teachings. What that tend to be around or popular in the. In say modern Buddhist circles, and that's both in the West as well as in Thailand. I mean, there's some things that the forest teachers teach that even though it's a Buddhist culture, I think, you know, well, this is Buddhism 101. Why did they not get the program? And well, no. I mean, it's human nature. So the emphasis that Ajahn Chah placed on, say, on sila, virtue, integrity, morality, precepts, I think fundamental human goodness. I mean, a sila is. Ajahn Chah didn't approach it as a bunch of rules to follow, and he was quite, but he saw it as integral to the whole path of if we're talking about the growth and maturity of a human being and human consciousness, and there needs to be a fundamental foundation in sila. And I think it's helpful to sometimes it's helpful to get the Buddha's jargon, you know, the words that the Buddha himself used, because sometimes when it's translated, then what gets conjured up is the kind of a lot of the cultural conditioning that we have from our own language, so that for many of us, and when say if sila is translated as morality, then I don't know about anybody else, but me, I get my back up pretty quick, and it's not that the Buddha or Ajahn Chah were not moral beings; they're incredible moral beings. But it was this virtue and integrity and just deep well of goodness arising out of a purity of heart. And it's also understandable sometimes where it doesn't get that much airplay or it gets skipped over. It is, and Ajahn Chah, I mean, he came to North America only one time in his life, and it was his second trip to the West. But it was one of the things that he noticed is not a whole lot of emphasis on that fundamental sila, as a foundation, and he ended up talking quite a bit about it in during his time in his second trip to the West, because it's to a certain degree it was sort of, well, you know, people are more interested in meditation and teachings on liberation, which is true, but as Ajahn Chah said, well, yeah, but if you know teaching Buddhism without sila is like sending someone out in the open sea in a leaky boat, and it's not a good start. And so but yeah, in Limpo, and I'm actually prepared for this, which is, it's not always what I do. But I know it's delightful to be reminded of Ajahn Chah's teachings in many ways. But yeah, in Lumpa Cha's vision of Sila, it's the basis of how to live together in the world comfortably and harmoniously. An image he used was this. In Thailand, the millipedes are really big. They have a lot of legs. You'd think that with that many legs, they would trip over each other. And it would really be difficult, but they don't. Those legs all work together. They move along pretty smoothly. And so that in the same way, it's possible to live together harmoniously as a community, as a society, as a culture. And of course, the sila is what provides that foundation for living together in a harmonious and smooth manner. On a social level, then stepping back from the tendency to selfishness, a sense of harmony is facilitated. So sila is not just a bunch of rules to be followed, but guidelines for how human beings can live together, not creating harm for each other and for fostering a sense of trust and well-being. And so that sense of sila, being, yes, there are these different precepts that the Buddha gives, but they are, and I think it's quite different from our Judeo-Christian background. These are training rules, and they are foundations for training ourselves in body, speech, and mind. And it's quite, explicit in the actual formula for taking the precepts in the scriptural language. It's like the first precept, Panatipata, Weramini, Sikapadang Samadhiyami, sort of the... I undertake the training rule to refrain from taking the life of any living creature. So it's a sort of one, it's done voluntarily, and two, you're making a determination to train. And the what is usually translated as precept is called sikapada, and pada literally means foot, and sika means to learn or to study or to educate oneself or to train. And of course, education is training. So this emphasis that Ajahn Chah made on sila. And there's through the day, I'll try to cover a variety of topics that I think. Again, Ajahn Chah emphasized and kind of typified his approach to teaching, and so that aspect of virtue. Another aspect of renunciation. I mean, just in the English language, you say renunciation, you, oh my God, I've got to give up something. And but because renunciation is something I'm missing out on something, whereas relinquishment is a bit nicer in the sense I'm actually giving up something, relinquishing something that's been a burden to my heart, and you realize, oh, this is and Ajahn Chah in so many ways continually pointed to this aspect of relinquishment, letting go, putting things down. Whatever we pick up is heavy, and be willing to put it down. He says, and you say, and we say, even something, you say, yeah, we pick up our phones. We pick up a lot. You know? You think, well, it's not so much, not so heavy. Yeah. But, there's a lot there. And there's a lot to everything. And so I've been carrying, just having to carry it around with us all the time. Along with that, there's all the extra baggage that comes with whatever we pick up. So that sense of relinquishment is being able to let go, to put down. Another aspect of Ajahn Chah's teaching that he would emphasize is aspect of this awareness. This, as I mentioned in the meditation instruction, this sense of the being, the knowing. This is a fundamental quality of mind, a fundamental nature of mind, that we can be plugging into, and it has the power to free the heart. And so this fundamental awareness, knowing quality of alertness and presence, and then the aspects of liberation. Ajahn Chah didn't, I mean, he didn't talk about it all the time, but he didn't shy away from talking about that. The whole point of the Buddha's teachings, whether it's for lay people or for monastics, whether it's for men or for women, for young or for old, for the educated, the uneducated, this was about liberation. The possibility of the Buddha's teachings is about freedom from suffering. It's not that far away. And the Buddha himself said the same thing. He said, if I thought you couldn't do this, or it can't be done, I wouldn't teach it. But because this can be done, therefore I teach this, I give this teaching. And he spent, I mean, his first inclination when he was first awakened was, well, I don't know if anybody's going to understand this. Maybe I won't bother teaching. But then, the heart of compassion arose, and okay, there are beings with little dust in their eyes. And he committed to 45 years of teaching to establish this dispensation that is given teachings of liberation for 2,600 years. So it's we're still benefiting from it so long ago, and in tremendous distance. And so it's something to over the day, I'll give. This morning, I'll touch on a couple things and a few things, and then see where we go. And this afternoon, I'll give another reflection. Oh, also, before I forget, I was asked to mention to everybody that, say, at the back are the there's sheets of paper, and if anybody has any questions, feel free to write them. I guess put them in the basket, and they will be collected about 12:15, collated and typed up, and so that the Q&A session will begin at 1 o'clock ish, whenever we're together after the meal time. I try to have the Q&A sessions at 1 o'clock. It's mainly because that's one of the few times when hopefully people don't fall asleep. So we start the afternoon with a meditation. I don't guarantee it. But hopefully it generates enough interest. So if anybody has questions, feel free to write them out. So this aspect of virtue, again, sila, there's an exchange that Ajahn Chah had when he was a young monk. He was worried about sila, about precepts, about his training rules. And he said, that, and this is him talking, it so happened that I had a chance to go and see Venerable Ajahn Mun. So I asked him, "Venerable Ajahn, what am I to do? I've just begun to practice, but I still don't know the right way. I have so many doubts. I can't find any foundation at all in the practice." He asked, "What's the problem?" "In the course of my practice, I picked up the Visuddhimagga, which is a very famous manual on practice and the teachings, and read it, but it seems impossible to put into practice. The contents of the aspects around sila, nidesa, samadhi, nidesa, banya, nidesa, the sections on sila, on virtue, sections on samadhi, our meditation, sections on banya, wisdom, insight, seem to be completely impractical. I don't think there is anybody in the world who could do it. It's so detailed and meticulous. To memorize every single rule would be impossible. It's beyond me." He said to me, "Venerable, there's a lot, it's true, but it's really only a little. If we were to take account of every training rule in the sila nidesa, that would be difficult, that is true. But actually, what we call this sila nidesa, this section on sila, on virtue, has evolved from the human mind. If we train the mind to have a sense of shame and fear of wrongdoing," these are translations for, and it's a very difficult term to translate, hiri and otapa, and because the hiri is a sense of shrinking back out of a sense of, this isn't appropriate for me. This is not my best side. And then a fear of wrongdoing is a fear of the consequences of one's action. So it's a foundation. But these are, again, what the Buddha called these, and one is, I'm trying to remember how Ajahn Jeff translates, is conscience. Anybody else remember? Yeah, conscience and concern. Yeah, that's it's trying to get away from old Judeo-Christian language. Conscience and concern. So it says, and the Buddha calls these qualities the protectors of the world, Lokapala. These are protectors of the world, and they're. And the reason why there is this sense of conscience, of hiri, is because one respects oneself. One has a respect, fundamental respect for oneself, so one doesn't want to stain the heart. And the reason why one has a fear of wrongdoing or a concern is that one has a respect for others. So it's a, these are extremely beautiful qualities, that bright qualities of the heart that protect the world. So that if we train this mind to have a sense of hiri and a sense of otapa, we will then be restrained, we will be cautious. This will condition us to be content with little, with few wishes, because we can't possibly look after a lot. When this happens, our mindfulness becomes stronger. We will be able to maintain mindfulness at all times. Wherever we are, we will make the effort to maintain thorough mindfulness. Caution will be developed. Whatever you doubt, don't say it. Don't act on it. If there's anything you don't understand, ask the teacher. Trying to practice every single training rule would indeed be burdensome, but we should examine whether we are prepared to admit our faults or not. Do we accept them? This teaching is very important. It's not so much that we must know every single training rule if we know how to train our own minds. So this is a, again, Ajahn Chah's approach to sila, is to more turning to the inner qualities that need to be cultivated in order for a natural virtue and integrity to arise, rather than, you know, in the same way that I talked about meditation, I'm trying to force the mind into a place of stillness and a place of concentration. In the same way with sila, one is reflecting on the what's the nature of one's own mind, what's the nature of one's intention. And that's something that I, of course, living with Ajahn Chah, I'd hear over and over and over again. You're keeping these, this container of the precepts in order to be a mirror for the mind and understand your own, the volition of the mind, the intention behind one's actions to speak or to act or to think or to conceive of anything. What's the fundamental impulse behind it? So so precepts are virtue, and sila is then a integrated part of the whole training of this body, speech, and mind. And particularly the mind, because if again, mind is a liar and a cheat. So we can justify just about anything. We've all got our own inner lawyer that is able to make a case for its preferences and its attachments. And so that having a sila as a basis. So Ajahn Chah would place tremendous emphasis on that. Another aspect or another kind of topic that I wanted to cover was the aspect of relinquishment, and just that sense of letting go. And of course, there's a well-known teaching that I was actually first presented in a collection of the first book that Jack did, Still Forest Pool, along with Paul Breiter. And so it's just this well-known teaching. If you let go a little, you'll get a little peace. If you let go a lot, you get a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you get complete peace. And just this is this path of practice, path of training, path of inclining the heart to that which is peaceful is not in trying to get it or make it or achieve it, attain it. It's realized through letting go, through relinquishment, and so that's such an important thing to get one's mind around. I say, well, especially when we experience some difficulty or some obstacle. You know, oftentimes we try to be really clever. You know, what do I need to do? How do I get there? And it's I think it's really helpful. Oh, what can I let go of here? What am I hanging on to? And the closer you look, the more you realize, wow, okay, I'm hanging on to a lot here. this aspect of relinquishment. Again, Jack talks about it in when he very first went to meet Ajahn Chah, and Jack had been, because he'd been a Peace Corps volunteer in Thailand, and he had lived in the northeast of Thailand. So as they get in Peace Corps, you get very, very good language training. And then he was living in the northeast of Thailand, so he managed to get a very good foundation in the northeastern dialect, which was what Ajahn Chah was. That was his primary language, and it wasn't until much later in his life that he really started. Like when Jack first went, when Ajahn Sumedho was already there, you wouldn't hear Thai spoken. It'd be the northeastern Laotian dialect, and which is it's a fun language, but it's really kind of down home Lao. It's fun, very direct. But anyway, he could when Jack went, he could speak, communicate with Ajahn Chah, which was, say, different than when I went, because you know, kind of wander off the hippie trail and show up at Ajahn Chah's monastery as a newly ordained monk with no background in language and not even any background in real training. Having to go through whoever was around who could translate in those days. But Jack had the good fortune to be able to communicate directly with him. So then when he arrived at Lopa Cha, his first greeting was, well, I hope you're not afraid to suffer. And of course, Jack took him aback really quickly and Jack asked him what he meant, and Lopa explained that there are two kinds of suffering. One that you turn away from and it keeps following you, and the second, which is the suffering you're willing to face and learn from. The second kind is what gives us the ability to be free. Lopa Cha was never afraid to make us confront this, and hence sometimes training with Lopa could be difficult. It pushed you into relinquishment. It pushed you into letting go, and so it was. But I think we all had a confidence in Ajahn Chah that this is difficult. He's pushing me to my limits of what I'm willing to let go of, but there's something there. It's like when I guess it was last year. It was last year. I was talking with my mom. My mom's still alive. She's 101, she said, "I'm cleaning up my stuff. I'm cleaning out my stuff, I'm getting rid of everything." He said, "I've got a box of all the letters you ever wrote when you were away," which I had no idea she kept any of that. And it was, yeah, it was all everything, basically all the letters and aerograms and whatnot that I sent. from the time I was just as a traveler, and then went to Thailand, and then ordained, and then stayed until I came to America here in 1997. So like from 73 through 97. So she had all these letters, and in one of them, I think it was in my third year as a monk, and I was explaining to my parents and my family that said, I haven't told you about this. And actually, this is the only letter that I have reread. I mean, I can't bear to look at them. Other people have read them, but I can't quite bring myself to reading it. But for some reason, this drew me. I think because I also had, there was one that I'd sent a whole bunch of slides from that year. I think it was from 1975. And yeah, I think it was 1975. Slides that I'd sent to my family for them to see. And they'd just been packed away all these years. So they were in perfect condition, and able to reprint them and make them available to people who were in those pictures. But anyway, I was saying to them, I don't think I've told you all yet about Ajahn Chah's 5-year plan. And said that it's that Ajahn Chah expects everyone to if you're going to train with him, to stay at least 5 years with him, so that I'm going to be, you're not going to be seeing me at least still for another 5 years, and but then I explained that, you know, there's just something compelling about Ajahn Chah's presence, and something I've never seen in anybody in my life, that he is able to be kind of peaceful and calm and clear, and in a word I did use that's always resonated with me, unshakable in the midst of everything. And I said, you know, it's a big monastery with lots of things, lots of people there, lots of a big community, and lots of things happening around, but he is always unshakable. And if I can stay longer here and gain some of that unshakability, that's what I want to be doing. So and again, it, you know, so much of it is, yeah, what are we willing to let go of? What are we willing to relinquish? Because so much of our, you know, what we're shaken by is not so much any particular impact of anything. It's how we feel about it, what we take exception to, what we get caught, what we get worried about, what we get fearful of, what we get upset about. And can we be unshakable? And of course we can be, otherwise these teachings wouldn't make any sense. But it's through this doorway of relinquishment, of letting go, that is the primary way of realizing that. So there's Ajahn Chah in one of his teachings, and it's from a teaching that was titled Unshakable Peace. The way of the forest masters is the way of renunciation or relinquishment, letting go. On the path, there's only abandoning. We uproot views stemming from self-importance. We uproot the very essence of our sense of self. I assure you, this practice will challenge you to the core, But no matter how difficult it is, don't discard the forest masters and their teachings. Without proper guidance, the mind and samadhi are potentially very deluding. Things which shouldn't be possible begin to happen. I've always approached such phenomena with caution and care. When I was a young monk, just starting out in practice during my first few years, I couldn't yet trust my mind. However, once I'd gained considerable experience and could fully trust the workings of my mind, nothing could pose a problem. Even if unusual phenomena manifested, I'd just leave it at that. If we are clued in to how these things work, they cease by themselves. It's all fuel for wisdom. As time goes on, we find ourselves completely at ease. And so that ease is accessed through, you know, what we're willing to let go of, what we're ready to relinquish and abandon. So it's such an important flavor of the teachings of Ajahn Chah, and he exemplified it in his own life. I mean, he never held back, in the sense of, oh, you know, if somebody was interested in receiving teachings. I mean, he was always ready to just set aside his own preference or his own feelings, and always he was always there for people. He was ready to give. There's that quality of and to say relinquishment is not quite, doesn't really get the flavor of it, because it's still, when you say, like, I am relinquishing something, but when there's no self to get in the way, there's just this complete and utter letting go, and that's where ease comes from. It's like I'm thinking there was a monk who came to stay with Ajahn Chah, and he had practiced at different places, and he'd been on his own for a fair time, and done a lot of solitude practice, and then he was staying with Ajahn Chah, and he just found it irritating and frustrating to just the duties or the what was required, and also he was he recounts as he said, because he wanted to draw close to Ajahn Chah, so he asked to be to take a turn in being his attendant, but then being with Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Chah would receive people and talk to the villagers or the townspeople or visiting monastics, and he said, and this monk said, you know, sometimes it just sounded so mundane, and I just want to, and I'd start to get tired, and so I go tired of it, and I go to my breath immediately, and just try to not have to deal with that. And he said, as soon as I did that, it's like it was uncanny, because Ajahn Chah seemed to know my mind. He said, go and get me this. Oh, go and clean this spittoon for me. I'll do it. He's always finding something for him. He couldn't ever settle in the way that he liked. And so then, and then finally he got fed up and went to pay respects to Ajahn Chah and asked permission to leave. He wanted to take leave and go somewhere else. And Ajahn Chah said, well, you're welcome to to leave. You can go back and to your cave and learn how to be peaceful there. Or you can stay on here and learn how to be peaceful anywhere. He stayed, much to his credit and his discernment. That took relinquishment, and we have to say that relinquishment on so many different levels. But in the end, it really comes back to this sense of self, this sense of me and my preference, me and my agenda, me and my views and opinions. And that's something that Ajahn Chah was asked, you know, what's the biggest obstacle for practitioners, you know, whether they're monastic or lay people, and Ajahn Chah, yeah, views and opinions. Yeah, people, because they seem so right. But yeah, give some space, and you realize, I can let that go as well. Okay, I think that's enough to reflect on this morning. It's sort of moving toward the meal time, and maybe we can just sit quietly for a little bit and let those teachings percolate a bit and see if anything resonates. So we could transition to mealtime. As monastics, we're allowed to eat between dawn and noon. So, of course, this being daylight savings time, we've got a bit of extra time. One of the aspects of it is that you have food that we receive has to be offered, in Thailand, and in the morning, then the monastics go out into the local villages and receive alms from the villages and villagers, and it was one of the things that Ajahn Chah was quite adamant when they very first went to England. On Ajahn Chah's return, he had Ajahn Sumedho and monks, a few of the monks, stay on to help establish something, see if it was a viable thing to do in London. And they did have a center that was offered. But Ajahn Chah said, make sure you go alms round every day. Ajahn Sumedho said, well, you know, we've tried it a few times and nobody offers us anything. And Ajahn Chah says, you're not going for the food, you're going for the people. And that's how the say the Sangha got to be known, and then after a couple of years in London, they've moved out to the countryside and established forest monasteries. But the you know, it was from only from time to time would they get actual food when they went along, so. But they did receive the forest that they established. The first one, Chidhurst Forest Monastery, was a result of alms round. A jogger on Hampstead Heath saw these monks all the time, and then he finally screwed up his courage and talked to them, and ended up, he says, you know, oh, I've got this forest that I'm really looking for a steward to look after it. And Ajahn Sui says, well, we're forest monks without a forest. So you never quite know what happens on Ramsar. But anyway, the many people have brought offerings of food this morning, and the monastics could go and receive them. And then when it's all received, the monastics can put it into their alms bowls. We'll go and have our meal. Then before that, we'll give a blessing, and then we'll leave it. It's then after we're gone, then the food's all yours. Enjoy yourselves, and then, you know, just have some time to have the meal, have a bit of a relaxing time. It's a beautiful day at Spirit Rock today, and then come back around about 1 o'clock ish. See how everything's cleaned up and neat and tidy. We'll come back here.